Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Tzadin Aleph. Now, we've been discussing what is the din about Benin Dichrin in the case where one woman was married died in the lifetime of her husband. He then went ahead and married a second wife, and now the second wife died after him, and we wanted to know whether is there ketuvat benin dichrin, even though it's only going to be with one set of children, which is unfair, is perceived as unfair, because the second wife is only going to be collecting a ksuva, and if there's anything left, her children will be collecting whatever is left after the first group of children walk off with everything that the father had inherited from their mother. Then we discussed another issue. Since we've determined that there needs to be a motar dinner in order for ketuvat benin dichrin to go into effect, the question is whether the actual payment of a ketuvah to the second wife, even if not one penny beyond the benin dichrin will be left after it's paid off, whether you need the penny, because the payment of the ketuvah is itself the motar dinner. It means that the heirs got together and paid off a debt. Now, it happens to be, of course, that debt was to other kids that are also heirs. But so what? Bottom line is, the estate paid off, and therefore there was way more than a Moser dinner. Unfortunately, we don't have access to it because it was used to pay for the ketuvah. So this is the way that we worked it out yesterday, that it could be that the machlokasin that we had are about the Moser Dinner issue, and the Moser Dinner issue could be understood in numerous ways. Does it have to be real estate, or could it be batat? Does it have to be currently in the estate, or can it be coming into the estate because of a bond that's due? And we weren't sure. It may be that there are machlokes in between the Tanoim about whether Ksuvas Benin Dichrin is actually in effect where one wife dies b'chayav and one b'moto, possibly. We weren't able to prove it. And it's possible that we only have these more complex machlokasin about the din of Moser Dinner. Omer Mar Zutra. So we got up to Omer Mar Zutra, Mishmeder of Papa, to paskin halacha about all of our past discussions. Hilchata achat b'chayav, v'achat b'moto yeshlem ktuvat benin dichrin. So the psak is exactly the way that we were medayik from our Mishnah. And the psak is that indeed, as the other diak from our Mishnah, namely that a ketuvah is naaseit motar lechaverta. Now, the truth is, you'd think that you don't really have to say both of these things, because if the moment you talk about ketuvah naaseit motar lechaverta, what's the case? Huh? What's the case? The only case I can think of ketuvah naaseit motar lechaverta is a case where there are two wives, one of whom died in the lifetime, one of whom died afterwards. The one who dies afterwards is being paid off. There wasn't an additional meiser dinner. And now we're wondering whether the paying off of that ketuvah is good enough to provide the Moser dinner for benin dichrin. So the moment you open up your mouth and you start talking about a case of a ketuvah being a motar dinner, you're already telling me that there is a case of benin dichrin with two wives where it looks unfair. So what do you have to talk about? What are we, two-year-olds here? Any idiot, the moment that they hear the words ketuvah naaseit motar lechaverta, immediately hears, oh, interesting. So in other words, we're definitely assuming that there is a ketuvat benin dichrin, even where akas b'chayev, akas b'moso, right? So therefore, ask the Gemara, what's the business over here? I mean, look, I understand that Mar Zutra was saying these two things. So Bishlama, if Mar Zutra had only been teaching akas b'chayev, akas b'moso, yeshlem ksuvas benin dichrin, and he wasn't talking about ketuvah naaseit motar lechaverta. Okay, so then that would have been up in the air. And I might have thought, you know what? I guess it's still possible that we would only say benin dichrin if there's a motar dinar besides the ketuvah. But ilo lo. Okay, so I understand why he had to teach me that tzuvah naaseh k'motah l'chavertah. But all he needed to teach was that. Lashmuinan k'tuvah naaseh k'motah l'chavertah. And I would know, well, what case are we talking about? Where would a k'tuvah be motah l'chavertah? Obviously, in a case where there were two wives, one died b'chayav, and one died b'moto, and it's clear that yesh lahem k'tuvah benin dichrin. There you go. So I think basically he got a lot of extra words in here that were absolutely unnecessary. Oh, that's because you think simplistically, my dear friend. I'll tell you why it's by no means enough. Yashmin and Alchi, let's just say that Marzuchu would only have said, K'tuvana set motar l'chavrata. You want me to explain to you how that leaves us totally up in the air when it comes to the question of an indichrin? Okay, let's think about this case. Three wives, okay? Two of those wives died in his lifetime. One of them died after his death. Now, the one that died after his death did not have any sons. She had a girl. Now, this girl wants the ketuvah, okay? But she does not get any rights to the inheritance of the father because they're sons. So now what happens? Certainly, there's no question that k'tuvah benin dichrin is completely fair because both sets of boys are going to be getting the same k'tuvah benin dichrin rights. A girl anyway is not yoresha, so there's nothing to look unfair. And therefore, why would we not have benin dichrin where nobody's got anything to fight about? How would that address our question of where you have one wife with boys and another wife with boys, and one of them dies b'chayav, and one of them dies b'moto, and has a son, and there we've got a problem. In that case, I would certainly say, oh man, this could be serious court cases. That's why, kamash malan, this is precisely why Marzurcha had to tell us, we are not worried about insuye, even in that case, and there is a din of benin dichrin, and that's it. Gentlemen, I think maybe we can get away with this. I don't know whether we can get away with this for tonight, or do we have to finish this amud? I'm about to expire. But okay, listen, you know, it's good to die on the battlefield. So we can have Sir Richard. We can have Sir Richard introduce the Mishnah.
Rabbi, right. You're the boy. And, you know, you can take a break. You're allowed. You know, it's not.
I don't know whether this counted as a full daf. I mean, we can't not do a daf for the daf yomi. That's crazy. So we better.
Well, we can all go over to Barnea's sukkah.
That's right. That's a good idea.
For me, I'm too.
Okay, so I think maybe we had best introduce the Mishnah, and let's hope I can get through it. Go for it. Okay, so now this Mishnah is basically going to be talking about a lot of the issues that we've already spoken about, because we've talked about the fact that the next Mishnah meeting now is going to introduce the issues of Moser Dinner. So here's the case. Somebody's married to two women. Same case. We're used to this case. And they both die. So if they both die, and then he dies. And now each one of them wants the specific ketuvah of their mother. Classic case of benin dichrin. There's no baalat chov. There's two families with two mothers. But they had different size ketuvot. So they want to inherit their own mother's ketuvah. And there's only enough money to pay off the two ketuvot. Then there is no ketuvat benin dichrin at all. And then they split the estate. Because remember, there's no benin dichrin if it violates the fundamental rules of inheritance midiraisa. Fine. But if there's just one dinner extra, so that even if they would pay off the two ketuvot, there would be one dinner for the sons of the two mothers to split equally, in that case, each group takes their respective mother's ksuva. Elo notlim ktuvat imam, ve'elo notlim ktuvat imam, and everything's fine. Now look, one of the groups over here, in the first case, where there wasn't enough money to go around, they're devastated because their mother had a ketuvah of $1 million that was given to the father, and he inherited it, and they were supposed to inherit it. And this other woman had a ketuvah of $1,000. So they want their $1 million. So they come forward and they say, what's the problem over here? There's no moser dinner? Here, here's a sack of dinners. It is now part of the estate. Okay? Now there's plenty to go around. Are we all happy? Excellent. Pass us $1 million, please. And we'll split the dinners together with the other woman's children after we pay her off. No problem. So if they come along and they say, obviously, the children of the mother of the big silver, they come along and they say, okay, we're going to put in additional value over here, all right? That way we can take our mother's silver. Whatever at the time, we can't add whatever at the time fell to the Yerusha, as the Beis Din defines it, that is the value. That's all there is that you have a right to analyze. Now, how about if there were nechasim that had not yet arrived, so that there were going to be additional money in the estate, and maybe the grandpa is still alive. When he dies, there's going to be a lot of extra money. It has nothing to do with it. Right now, that money is not part of the father's, who's now deceased himself, is not part of his estate, and it doesn't count. That maybe next week, grandpa, who's on his deathbed, it's irrelevant. At the time of the Yerusha, this is what the Yerusha was worth, and it's not considered to be ra'ui kimuchzak. Rabbi Shimon Omer, afilu yesham nechasim she'en lehem achrayut. As a matter of fact, says Rabbi Shimon, why are we talking about adding extra cash? It wouldn't help you a bit. Because even if there's tons of extra cash in the estate, it does not go towards giving us a motar dinner. Motar dinner has to be a motar dinner of real estate, not of metaltolin. And therefore, afilu yesham nechasim she'en lehem achrayut, it doesn't count. Eino klum. At yusham nechasim she'yesh lehem achrayut, yoter al shtei ketuvot dinar. We need to have two ketuvot plus the real estate to pay them both off and an extra dinner. Tana rabban. Suppose one woman had a ketuvah of 1,000 dinar, and one woman had a ketuvah of 500 dinar. And now we've got 1,501 dinar in the estate. So then, elu notnim ktuvatimam, ve'elu notnim ktuvatimam. But im lav, if you don't have that extra dinner, then basically there is no case of splitting. And the only thing that the Braisa is clarifying, I mean, otherwise it's just repeating the Mishnah. The only thing that the Braisa is clarifying is that even if the ktuvot are very different values, it's still going to be the case that even though you're saying because of one lousy extra buck, these kids are going to lose the extra $1 million that their father inherited. So if I had only read the Mishnah, I might have thought, well, maybe we're talking about whether they're the same. No, comes from the Braita to make it very clear. It is not the same. Pshita, now it's also obvious that if the father died and it was worth three times as much as it's worth now. Now we come along to the point where we're ready to split it, and there's been a stock market crash, and the value of the estate has declined precipitously, and therefore they're now mitmatu, and we no longer have the extra dinner. That doesn't matter, because at the time of the death of the father, the ketuvat benin dichrin went into effect. So therefore, they would inherit. Kvar zachu be'em yorshim, and they don't lose their Yerusha just because there is a change in the value subsequently. How about the other way around? How about if at the time of the death, it was worth only as much as the two ketuvot without the motar dinar, and now there was a jump in the real estate value, so that at this point, before we actually split it, there is a motar dinner. Does it now suddenly go back into effect, the ketuvah benin dichrin, or did they lose it at the time of the death because there was no right of benin dichrin at that point? Well, Tashma, let us see about an actual case. There was an estate that was the inheritance from the gentleman of Bar Tartzur, and it was not worth very much. It did not have a Moser dinner to cover his wife's children's benin dechrin. And then there was a jump in value a month later, and now they come to Rav Amram, and the ones who had the smaller ksuva, they said, listen, it's not fair that you should give an indichrin, because at the time of Dad's death, there was no extra dinner. And therefore, the indichrin was canceled, and we should split the estate evenly. Of course, the other ones are saying, but now there is enough. Amar Lahu, sort of Amram, said to the family of the smaller ksuva woman, listen, I would advise you to make some kind of deal with them, because if you can't get them to settle, you are going to lose. And I'm telling you right now, because Mi'ikar Adin, they have a right to collect an indichrin in this case. You better make up with them. You know, you don't have to tell them you talk to me, but you could just come along and tell them, okay, how about we make a deal? You know, you'll take half of your ksuvas ben indichrin, something like that. Because otherwise, you're going to lose out completely. Well, they didn't listen to him, and they were stubborn, and they were going to go to court. So, sure enough, Amalu, he said, I'm telling you right now, if you don't settle, I am going to be puncturing you with a kind of thorn that doesn't cause bleeding, meaning I'm going to put you into cheren. I have time for this kind of shtuyot. You guys go and settle. So he sends them to Reb Nachman. And Reb Nachman, okay, yeah, he didn't want to get involved in what's going to happen. He says, okay, you want to go to court? Go to court. So Amar Lam Reb Nachman. Reb Nachman said, look, in exactly the same way that when at the time of death, there were a lot of extra money, and that way, even though if afterwards it went down, we told you that the yorshim were already zeicha, and you can't take it away from them afterwards. The same thing is true when it was nechassim muatim, and there was no extra dinner. Zachu b'hem yorshim, the small ksuva already had the right to split equally. You cannot take it away from them, which is very ironic, because Reb Nachman said that Reb Amram was wrong, and here he was threatening them. And Lamaisa, it turned out that Reb Nachman paskin in their favor. At least this is the way that Rashi understands the sugya. Now, tomorrow we'll talk about an opposite approach to the sugya, and we'll start a bunch of fascinating little sales and see what happens where property values change afterwards. The last machlokas that we had about the question of what happens if the evaluation of the motar dinner changes between the time of the death and the time of the actual coming to collect. So you will recall that the psak that we got yesterday, the Gemara came out after all of the discussions that we had, that the din is that we will apply the halacha of benin dichrin even in a case where one of the family's mother died in the lifetime of the father, and therefore there would have been a benin dichrin inheritance. The second one, however, died after the father, and therefore the collection of her ketuvah was coming as a baalat chov. That nonetheless, even though that creates a sense of unfairness in the children of mother B, who died after the father, because they don't collect from the father anything other than the motar dinner, which was left, that nonetheless we do have such a takana. But there does need to be a motar dinner. That's how we pass. As far as what the motar dinner is, that was still an open machlokas, Can it be cash? Does it have to be real estate? Can it include money that is coming into the estate, or did the money have to be there at the time? Those are peripheral issues to us, because right now what happened is that the last thing we discussed was the question of what if there is a change in the value. So we had already established yesterday, everybody's ready to accept the fact that if at the time of the death of the father, there was definitely value that was sufficient to be the motar dinah to allow the Yerusha D'oraita, please get all of these ideas straight, to allow the Yerusha D'oraita at least of one dinah, so that the Takana D'rabbanan of Benin Dichrin would not have wiped out entirely the din of Yerusha D'oraita by taking its place with this new Takana D'rabbanan, that there's, in a case where there's exactly enough money to pay off the two families, their mother's ksuva. But that the Rabbanan didn't want to do, because it would look like the Rabbanan were canceling the D'oraita in order to provide that ketuva. Fine. So we said, if at the time of death, the original Yorshim that had the right to the Benin Dichrin were okay because there was a motar dinah, so at that moment they were zocha to their Yerusha. Then if the value goes down, that's not going to change. We can't take it away from them because now the value has gone down. But in reality, it was a Yerusha D'oraita and everything is fine. So the machloket that we got into yesterday was a lawsuit in which it was originally muatim. At the time of the death of the father, it was muat. And then later on, the price went up. So the question is, was it possible to now reevaluate it and say we should go according to the current value, which would allow a Yerusha of Ketuvah Benin Dichrin, because now it's worth enough to give us an extra zuz? Or are they in their rights to say, the Yorshim that have the lesser Ketuvah, are they in the right to say, look, at the time of the death, we already had it that way? So it turned out that yesterday we had a machlokas Rashi. Tosas, we explained the Gemara according to Rashi's approach, in which Reb Nachman ended up paskening that the din is that it should be exactly the same, and that in the same way, which sounds like, and this is how Rashi indeed understands it, which sounds like we're coming in on the side of the people of the Yerusha Mu'etet. They now say, you know, okay, we want to be able to have our Yerusha. But the truth is that if you recall, they were threatened before they went to Reb Nachman. Reb Amram threatened them that if you're not going to make a deal, then you're going to end up losing. So that the way Rashi is understanding it, when Reb Nachman said, "Kishem Shemirubin Umit Nit Ma'atu," the same thing would be true in the opposite case over here. It's just like over there, Zochu Bem Yorshim, the Yorshim of the Ketuvas Dichrin, Benin Dichrin of the big Ketuvah, they already got it. But the same thing would be true where there were only Nechasim Muatim without the extra dinner. So now the small Ketuvah were already Yorish, meaning not the Ketuvah, but Yorish the property. And therefore they split it evenly. This is the way that Rashi understood it. This is the way the Rabbi Yochananel understands it. However, as Tosis points out, we could understand it opposite, which was sort of more normal, that Reb Nachman and Reb Amram agreed. And when Reb Amram sent to Reb Nachman, he had already warned him, "I'm telling you what the court's going to end up paskening. He's going to pasken against you." And the reason that it would be reasonable to paskin against you, says Tosis, in this case would be because basically if we now have sufficient money, so it doesn't look like you're being mevatel to get the D'oraita Yerusha, right? Bottom line is there is a Yerusha. What do you care how it works out? Remember, the entire idea of demanding that there be a extra dinner was basically an appearances issue, right? We don't want the Rabbanan to look like they're destroying the Yerusha. Okay, so in this case, since now it's worth a lot of money, it doesn't look that way. So there are two very different ways of understanding the final psak of Reb Nachman. Either he was in agreement with Reb Amram, or he actually canceled Reb Amram's threat and came in on the side of the Mu'atim, and they, when he says you already got it, means you already got the Nachla, not you already got the smaller Ksuv. Okay, we continue now on the Daf Tzadik Aleph Amud Beit. At the top is where we're up to. And what we're talking about over here is some very interesting cases in which the valuation changes. But the question is, in our Mishnah, remember, the valuation of the estate, the Yorshim came up to the Beis Din and they said, you guys valuated the estate as being worth precisely the amount of the two ketuvot, and therefore we weren't zocha in the Benin Dichron of our mother. We lost $1 million on this deal. So what we want to do is we want to add value to our father's estate. And so here's the extra value. So the Mishnah said, you can't do that. The valuation is defined by the Beis Din at the time of the death. You can't change it. Now, what about in a case where the valuation is very much nogea, the collection of a debt? And it sounds similar to the Mishnah, and we're going to bring some interesting cases where we mistakenly tried to bring a raya from the Mishnah. So let's take a look at these cases. We have two cases that are basically exactly the same, and there's a lot of discussion. So why did we need to talk about the two cases? We'll speak about that afterwards. But here's the two cases. Case number one, a guy owed $1,000. So Avimaski be Alpha. There was a contract against him for 1,000 sous, and the borrower did not have any money. But what he did have is he had two very valuable mansions, and each one of them was worth 500, but he had sold those two mansions at 500 apiece to another guy. So this guy is the Lakuach, right? He's a buyer. And the question over here is, of course, when you buy something, you get a guarantee that it's going to pay back to you if somebody comes along and collects it. Okay, so this guy bought it. Now, the one who was holding the chov, the Baal chov, was holding a shtar with a lien against these mansions because that's all that he can collect from since the borrower didn't have a dime to his name. So he comes and he gets a court order that passes one of these beautiful homes to him. And he's in court trying to get a court order for the second one against the remainder of the lien. So what happened is the actual buyer, who was really very in love with these homes and did not like the idea of losing them. So he came into court and he said, now, wait a minute. Here is $1,000 in cash, which is connected the entire debt, okay? You're saying that you want to take one of these homes for 500, I mean, in our terms, $500 million, $1,000, whatever, right? Well, I'm telling you that that is a big mistake, buddy, because that home is worth a full thousand. That's 100,000, let's say, in our terms, right? Or a million. And you're going to collect just one of them for the million, and I'll prove it to you. If you want to collect that for only 500,000, I'm telling you right now, here's $1 million in cash. I'm ready to buy it for a full million. So you make up your mind. If you really like the house, I can't make you sell it to me because you already collected it. However, you have to admit that the house was worth the full million that was owed. If you refuse to admit that, I'm taking this house back and I'm giving you the cash for it. I mean, it's ridiculous. Why should I let you take my $1 million home? And the proof of its value of $1 million is the fact that I'm giving you $1 million in cash. So I understand if you insist that you want to keep it and that should be the $1 million payout. Nothing I can do about that because you're out of lien on it. By the way, that's not so simple, because there is a big machlokas about whether a buyer has the right to force a lender to accept cash instead of property. Now, I don't want to get in the way of Gavi's driving, but hopefully he'll stop for a minute and write this down, or he will remember it. But a very important nekuda in this sugya is whether a lokeach is matzi lesaluke bedami. Can a buyer force a balchov to accept cash and not be able to take the property. And that's a big machlokas in Bava Metzia, and many learners Tosis brings here that that is good for the machlokas in our sugya. But that is not necessarily the case, because it's possible to make the type of lien that can prevent that kind of thing, at least according to many Rishonim. So suppose you make an apotiki. Remember that the word apotiki is an imported Greek term, which we turn into Hebrew, as we always do when we import words, and we make it into apotehekoi, into Aramaic, really. On this specific piece of land, that's where your rights of collection are limited to. So despite the fact that we call it a limitation, it's also an addition, because we're saying, look, this is your land in the event of non-payment, which is entirely different than saying you have a right to get your money in the event of non-payment and you can use the land to collect from. Here I'm saying this is your field, basically, if you're not paid back. All right. So in this case, the guy who wanted the house and who had bought the house for $500, now what's he trying to do? Essentially, he's trying to up the value, which is very similar to the case in the Mishnah. Can you up the value of a piece of property by simply offering more for it? It sounds very similar to what it is that's happening in the Mishnah. The group that has the Ktuvat Benin Dichrin wants to up the value of the estate by putting money into it. So can you do that kind of thing? The Mishnah said you cannot. You can't up the value. And therefore, in this case, when the buyer was offering $1 million, and therefore the Baal Chov had a choice. If he wants to keep the house, then he has to accept that it's worth $1 million. And if he wants his $1 million back that he lent, then he's going to have to take the cash if he doesn't really think the house is worth that kind of money. And therefore he says to him, Amar Leih, so the buyer says to him, look, Ishavi Lecha Alfazuzi, Lechai, if you admit that this wonderful mansion is worth $1 million, I can't force you out of it because you already collected it. But if you're not, then it's not a legal collection because it's really worth more. And I'm showing you it's worth more because here's $1 million. Get out of the house. Elo, Shkil Alfazuzi, take your $1 million and leave. And leave me both of the houses that I bought. So this became a machlokes. Rami Bar Chama's reaction was, okay, same as the Mishnah. The Mishnah is trying to artificially jack up the value of the actual property that was the estate of the father by putting more into it. And this guy's trying to jack up a price artificially of a house by going ahead and paying more for it, which of course really does have an impact on the real estate in the area. If somebody pays $1 million for a house that was recently sold for half that, then the property values go crazy, right? So that's what this guy is doing. Can you do that? But says Rami Bar Chama, it says in the Mishnah that if the Yatomim come along and they say, okay, we're going to artificially inflate the value of, and it's not artificial either. We're actually going to put in some extra money. So it'll be worth a dinner more. And then we're able to collect our mother's Ktuvat Benin Dichrin, from our father before these other guys get anything. Says they can't do that. They are stuck with the value that the original assessment was at the time of the death of the father. To which Rava said, I don't understand. It's not in the least bit similar. How can Rami Bar Chama say that it's the same as the case of the Mishnah? It's not. In the case of the Mishnah, if we would allow the evaluation at the extra dinner, we are going to cost the smaller families ksuva. We're going to cost them a loss of $250,000. Because like this, they can insist that they want to split the father's estate half and half because the Benin Dichrin was shoved out by the fact that there wasn't a Moser dinner. And now by making it worth the Moser dinner, you're costing them that because now they can't collect. It all went to pay up the Benin Dichrin and all that was left was a buck instead of $1 million. Oh my God, a disaster. So therefore, you can't do it because you're causing a loss to the other family. But over here, look, the guy who lent the money by your putting him in, you're backing him into the corner, right? You're telling him, look, if you really like the mansion, so do I. I'm telling you that this mansion's worth $1 million, and here's the proof, right? Waved in your face, $1 million, ready to take. So you could keep it, but then don't you dare think about taking the other one because you already got your $1 million, right? Bottom line is that this person is going to end up not losing. In other words, if he's willing to accept that it's worth $1 million, so he lent $1 million, he got $1 million. If he accepts the cash, he lent $1 million, he got $1 million. So really, what are you doing? You're not hurting him in any way. You're just making it impossible for him to take the actual house, but he's not losing any money. Alpha yoimi, alpha shakil. He lent $1,000, he's getting back $1,000. So therefore, you, in this case, says Rava, you would be allowed to do it. So as Tosis explains, this thing that Rava is claiming seems on the surface to be outrageous. The guy already went into court. He already collected the house. Once he collects the house, nobody can force him out of that house. How are we now ex post facto forcing him out of the house by inflating the value of the house after he already collected it? I mean, it seems crazy. Unless, and therefore, there are many of the Rishonim who say that the deal is that you can always buy off someone by being misalik him bedamim. That's the question. That would gufa be the machlokas. And that means that Rava is saying that I could actually have paid you back cash anyway, right? So that would mean that you don't really have rights to the house. All you have is rights to the value. Okay, I'm offering you the value. Now, if you already collected the value, okay, I understand. But then you have to admit that you collected the value. So that Rava holds that matzi l'saluke bezuze, which is the technical term. Masha enken Rami Bar Chama apparently holds that lo matzi l'saluke bezuze, and he doesn't have the right to keep him away. Okay, Tosfos himself says, not necessarily is that the machlokas, and the truth is there are many other issues over here that get involved into that machlokas, and the question of even whether that machlokas would apply, because was it applied even for a lakoach, or was it only applied to the actual borrower? That's another machlokas. So therefore, some learn that basically all that they did over here is they had evaluated it in Besa, but they never gave him a shtar chalita, which is the actual fact that it's his. And first they wanted to see whether they could sell it for more. The tremendous amount of detail in this issue. This is another one of the examples of what the ktuvot, the second ktuvot is called Shas Katan, because it has so many fundamental questions that are brought up in the context of a woman who's collecting her ksuva. So we won't go into this here because it's really a sugya of a metzia. And here we'll just learn it kipshute. That the question is he matzi saluki bedamim or not matzi saluki bedamim? And that would be the question between the two approaches of Rava Rami Bar Chama. The other obvious approach, which is the approach of Tosfos, is whether the, which is much more mistaber because it's coming in terms of this Mishnah, is whether artificially changed valuations have legal validity. Now that seems to make it fit right smack bang into our circuit. And that would be the question between them. Nothing to do with Matzi L'Saluki. So now the question is, the guy wants a shtar tirfa. Now shtar tirfa is when people were toreif. Remember the word for taking away a field from a buyer is toreif. We're toreif, we grab it out of his hands like a wolf would grab his prey, right? Now, since this was sold with achrayut, achrayut means that there's property insurance. Since it was sold with achrayut, so now he can go back to the person that he bought it from and collect whatever he lost. Obviously, in this case, the person he bought it from doesn't have a penny. Because if he did have a penny, then the original loan would have had to been paid back from that rather than taking it from him. However, he wants his shtar tirfa because you never know. What if more property comes into this guy's rishus? And the Rishonim list a lot of possibilities where he could get property subsequently. So he wants a Shtar Tirfa. Currently, he won't be able to use it, but he might be able to use it in the future sometime. How much is the Shtar Tirfa written for? Because let's consider a situation in which I would have bought property from someone, invested a lot of money in the property. So I paid $500,000 for the property, and I put in additional things into it, and now it's worth $1 million. This guy owed $1 million. Comes along the creditor, and he takes the property, and he says, oh, perfect, $1 million. But I say, wait a minute, $500,000 of that was the money that I invested. You can't take it. Tough. You have property insurance. Go collect the full property insurance from the guy who sold it to you. And that property insurance covers anything that you put into the property up till the value of the loan. Aha. So in this case, there's two ways of looking at it. Because what I could say is, okay, the value of the property really was increased by the fact that I was willing to pay $1 million for it. And this person actually accepted it for that. It's worth $1 million. All right. So then now that I want a Shtar Tirfa, which is what allows me to go back and collect from the man who sold me this property, if he ever gets property back in his own life that I'd be able to collect from. So I come back and I say, listen, buddy, I basically paid off your whole loan with the property that this guy took. What are you talking about? That property was worth $500,000. That's what you paid me. I know, but the price went up. What do you mean the price went up? It only went up because you waved $1 million in his face and he happened to want it. It was a private deal. Don't tell me the price went up. So how, in fact, do we evaluate it? Do we look at it as the original amount? You paid $500,000. I'm ready to pay you back $500,000 for what they took away from you. But the artificial inflation, that's not my problem. You went ahead and you made a deal with him. That's not on my behalf. So what do you do? So Ravina says, well, bottom line is the guy accepted it as full repayment for his loan, and therefore it's worth $1,000. Whereas Rav Avira says, that makes no sense. The guy only paid $500,000. He's got the other mansion that was worth $500,000. So you can only write it for $500. And in fact, that's halacha. You can only write it for $500. Now, there's a lot of explanations why this is true. It could be because we don't see it as a real change in market value, or it could be because we look at it as basically paying it up in a way that was unrelated to the sale, in which case it's not my problem. Okay, there is the exact same issue, and there's a lot of discussion among the Mefarshim. If it's the exact same issue, why does Gemara bother bringing it up? In this case, a guy owed 100 zuz, and he had two small pieces of property. So he had like two lots, you know, and each one of them was worth 50. And he sold two of them to the same guy, which basically covered his entire debt. And then the one who had the $100 loan document, he comes along and he gets the court to give him one of them, which is half of his debt. And now he wants to collect the other half of his debt from the other one. And then the guy did the same thing that the guy did in the other case. He took the full 100, waved it in his nose and says, look, you know, I mean, this thing was you took it for 50. It's not worth 50. It's worth 100. And the proof of the pudding is that here's the 100 that it's worth, and I'm ready to pay you for it right now. So if you are willing to admit that you already collected your full 100 and get your filthy paws off of my other little piece of lot over there I was going to build a house on, so then, okay. But if not, so then you overcollected. Take the money and get out of here. I'm willing to give you the full 100. Same exact case, right? So he went ahead, if you're willing to accept the new evaluation of the lot for 100, that's fine, then I can't get you out. But if you refuse, here's the cash. Get out of here. Just leave me both of them. So in this case, Rabbi Yosef also thought it's the same as the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, if the Yorshim, afterwards of the smaller ksuva, if the Yorshim say, You don't have a right to Binyan Dikrin. And then the other Yorshim say, what, we're going to lose $500,000 because of the fact that we're missing one buck? Let's put in an extra buck. It says you can't put in an extra buck. That valuations in court are real, and you can't change them by making these arbitrary relationships. So the same thing is true over here. And in this case as well, Abaya Tainas, it's not the same. Because in the case where over there, if you're going to add money, you're going to cost the children of the mother who had the smaller ksuva $500,000. Because now they're not going to be able to inherit their father's estate. Because it's all going to be taken away by the Benin Dichrin folk. So therefore, of course, the Mishnah says you can't do it. However, in this case, the guy doesn't lose anything. Basically, he lent you 100. Hachamai Pseida Itle. He lent this other fellow $100. You're paying him back. It's $100. What's in his business? Just because he happens to want the lot, not being able to get the lot is not a loss. So therefore, maybe you can inflate values. It's amazing the number of contemporary issues that are involved over here. It's absolutely astounding. But anyway, I mean, you feel like your mom is in a courtroom, you know, today. So now the question is, okay, so if we do that and the guy accepts it as the full value of his $100, what is the tirfa? Remember, the tirfa is the shtar that's written to be able to recollect what I lost in having a guy walk off with the property that I bought. If the event that he ends up with money, I'm able to go back because he guaranteed the value of the lot to me. So how much is that? Is that what I paid for the lot? Or is that what the lot was worth at its inflated value? By the way, some learn that the question of the tirfa bekama is a simple question. When you provide property insurance, do you provide the insurance only for the value of the money that was paid? Or do you provide the insurance if the property value was higher later and it was taken? That's the simple way of learning. The way we've been learning, the way that Rashi understands the sugya, is the question of whether the inflated value is the real value or that was just something that took place between two private parties. So how much is the shtar tirfa, which will allow me to collect my property insurance in the event that the seller ever gets any money? What do I write it for? So Ravina says, well, you write it for its currently inflated value, which was the meah. And Rav Avira says, no, you can only write it for 50. And the halacha is 50. So these two sugyas are really exactly the same. A lot of discussion, what the heck is the difference? Since when does a Gemara bring two completely exactly equivalent things in which the only thing that's different is something that appears irrelevant? Was it talking about a palace or was it talking about a lot? I mean, does it really matter? And the other issue is it a coincidence that in both of these cases, the inflated value was precisely double the original value because of the fact that there were two of the same thing, which is like almost an artificial construct. I mean, two exactly similar valuations. And that raises the suspicion that we're talking over here about the problem of the variability of real estate valuations, where over there, the question is, what would be considered, is there ona'a, is there a din of overpayment on real estate? And that's because evaluations are so plastic, because, I mean, you have these fluctuations all the time, very difficult to really give a clear-cut estimate. But, as Gemara says elsewhere, only up to 50%. Ha, ha, ha. So maybe that's why we're talking about 50% over here. But ain't a chinami. If there would have been, one of them would have been worth less, then you wouldn't even add 50% of the loan value. Maybe then this whole thing would have been under the laws of Onan. And there, for sure, you can't artificially jack up the price. Okay, that's a possibility. So in any event, what we're coming out with over here is that the difference would be in how it is that we look at it. And maybe, therefore, the difference between the two cases is whether the fluctuation on specifically an apadna, where Rashi defines apadna not here, but Rashi defines apadna elsewhere as meaning a palace, literally, because he uses the psukim in Daniel to talk about the king's palace as translated as apadna, in which case we're talking about a super duper Donald Trump property. Now, Donald Trump always knows how to get the best evaluation on his property, but that's because these kind of properties have a very, very limited kind of clientele. And, you know, you never know, if Musk decides he wants to buy Twitter for whatever billions he's ready to put in, a billion isn't worth as much as it used to be, you know. So maybe over there we've got more flexibility in value. Mashenka, when it comes to the just a normal lot, we don't have that kind of, those type of issues are the type of things that are discussed as to why the Gemara would bother telling us two different cases. In one of the cases, obviously, we're dealing with super values, which the thousand is meant to give over. In our terms, you know, $1 million, or nowadays, what's a million? Okay, Ahu Gavra, another case where we were talking about this little piece of property. So a guy who owed $100, and he dies, and all that was left of his property was a small lot that was worth $50. So now the guy's out of his money, but at least he comes and he gets his $50, right? Okay, so he goes into court and he wants a shtar tirfa to enable him to take the $50 by collecting this lot. Anyway, the Yatomim, who were the heirs of this guy who died, they take $50 and they pay him off because they don't want to lose the lot, which is right next to their home. Okay, so they give him $50. So they say, listen, don't take the field. It's worth $50. Here's $50, you know? So then the guy comes back to court and he says, listen, I'm still owed $50 by this guy. I mean, his kids were very nice. They paid me $50, but I still own another $50 and I've got a lien on this lot. So please write me out that shtar tirfa that I want to be able, shtar chalita, I want to be able to collect it, right? So, oh my God. So the kids come to a buy and they said, this is bum. We paid him his $50 in order to save the property. And now he's coming back and he's taking the property because we still owe him the other $50. That's outrageous. Isn't the fact that he accepted the $50 from us, isn't that basically the payment of the debt and that's all that he was able to collect? I mean, come on. This seems very nasty. So Abaye said, well, gentlemen, you know, there is a mitzvah on Yitomim to pay off a father's debts. So, I mean, we can't force you to do that. Now, why we can't force you to, there's a lot of discussion about this. We can't, there's a very universal Rashi over here, which is a big question of whether it's meant to be universal, but the Minchas Chinuch takes it as a universal statement. And a lot of places it's taken as a universal statement, not limited to our case, in which Rashi says, we do not force the kiyum of a mitzvah derabbanan. And so many learn that that's what Rashi holds all over, so that the court won't force it. And therefore, why is it only a mitzvah derabbanan? But wait a minute. Isn't there a mitzvah of kibud av? Yes, but kibud av doesn't include using your own money for kibud av. And over here, this is your money. Others learn the mitzvah of kibud av in this case would be relevant, not as kibud, but as yira. Why? Because this father is going to be known as a guy who borrowed money and never paid it back. And that's like a rishas. So to save their father's name, that's an inyan of mora, not just kovet. And the reason that we wouldn't force it is not because we don't force on a mitzvah derabbanan, because maybe for mora, there's a mitzvah deoraisim. It's going to cost you money. It's just if you're going to be providing him care, it has to come out of his wallet, not out of your wallet, but yira is not care. And therefore, what would be the reason that we don't force it? A fascinating issue, which is, since the Torah says, Laman Yarichun Yamecha, We have a general klal that when the Torah rewards you beferish, that is what it's about. And Besdin doesn't get involved. So it's matan tzchora ketuv betzida for Gavi, and it's written into the mitzvah, and therefore we're not going to be machriach you in Besdin. So what he said, therefore, Abaya said to the kids, listen, you're very sweet children, and you were kind enough to repay your father's debt, but you only repaid half of it. Now the guy is coming to claim the property. He has every right to claim the property. So Hanika Moy Mitzvah Aditu, you did a mitzvah, and now he's coming to use his lien. And his lien has not lost any of its legal validity, has it? So Hashta Kitoris Bedin Kotor, if he has every right to come along and to demand the property. However, obviously, it's defined by the context of your payment. This that Abaya said is only applies if they didn't say, we want to buy this little piece of property from you. So here's the 50. And instead of you're taking the lot, why don't you just leave it over here? Okay. So then what happened? Basically, what happened is that he collected it and they paid him for it. That has nothing to do with repaying a father's debt. That just has to do with the fact that they wanted to keep the lot and they paid for the lot. But so if they said to him, Hani Chamshin Zuze, we're paying you the value of this lot. We are not coming to pay you back daddy's debt. So then obviously, Saluki Salkua, they threw him out of the property by legally purchasing it. That's an entirely different issue. And that would, of course, not give him the right to come back and to recollect something that he already got out of. Now, the question is, talking about the context of giving money for money that was owed, and talking about that in the context of providing property insurance or not providing property insurance. And what we're doing over here is we are applying an understanding of what the interrelationships are in the cases. So that what Abaya was saying is, look, unless you specify otherwise, contextually, we look at the $50 that you paid, not as payment for the lot, but as an attempt to repay your father's bills. And that way people wouldn't collect it. You were hoping if they went back and collected it. I mean, you know, it's your tough luck. What would be in a case where the context is really confused? Here's a interesting and rather complex case. So what happened is a guy comes along. His mother has married another guy who is not his father. His mother never collected a ketuvah from his own father. So that basically by being married to this other guy, he wanted to get some kind of money out of the ketuvah. So his father was still alive. That means that the mother would not have been inherited by his father. She's married to another guy. So he has the possible rights, ultimately, of inheriting this ksuvah. So he wants to sell those rights. So he wants to sell it for 10 cents to the dollar. Ahu gav d'zavna l'ktuvah d'imei. That's called tovat hana'ah. Is the right of assignment. So we're calling this the right of assignment because basically, since the husband was still alive and his mother knew nothing about this, right? He was selling his own possible potential in this ksuvah. Because if his own father was going to die before his mother died, he would inherit this directly. And what are the chances? I mean, first of all, she might die before her current husband, in which case her current husband is going to inherit any of her money, which would include this ksuvah, and then he won't get it. Or for that matter, he's selling something which he has to survive his mother in order to inherit. How do we know he'll survive his mother? So this guy is pretty dubious when he's coming along and being offered a bond which this person doesn't own yet, and which he has no idea whether he's ever going to be able to collect because his mother might die before her current husband, or he might die. And therefore, the buyer says, I mean, like, you know, this is pretty iffy, this transaction. So I'll give you 10 cents on the dollar for the ksuv. So the guy says to him, okay, but if you want to do it that way, and you're such a pawn shop owner, you're giving me only 10 cents on this very valuable ksuv. You want me to do 100 push-ups right here in front of you if you're worried about me dying anytime soon? So I'm telling you right now, I'm going to sell it to you for 10 cents on the dollar, you bum. But I'm not guaranteeing it against any kind of losses. So if my mother finds out about it and she says, I ain't giving him no rights to sell no ktuva, it isn't his yet. What's he bargaining on my dropping dead? Absolutely ridiculous. So if she starts making a fuss, I'm telling you right now, I ain't going to court for you. And I'm not going to recompense you for anything that you paid for it. This is zero insurance. Just understand that, buddy. Last time I'll be walking into this pawn shop. Anyway, so what happened over here is very fascinating. He says, I'atya emu ma'arav. If she makes any trouble about it, lo mefatzina lecha, I am not going to court for you. And I'm not going to repay you. And in the end, his mother did die. And she was not ma'arav. And basically, she had survived this other husband, and he claimed, okay, that means I inherited this ksuva, but since I am the heir, I am now taking the place of my mother, and I am absolutely complaining about the rotten son, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the rotten son who went ahead and sold off his mother's ksuba for 10 cents on the dollar. I hereby protest, as my mother, of course, in my other identity as a wonderful son. Well, I never agreed to pay him back if my mother, who is now Mr. Hyde, if my mother, who is protesting, she just looks like me. So she's protesting, and I, good son, never agreed to take your side in court. So therefore, I want to cancel the sale. So Rami Bar Chama says, well, I mean, basically, he now stands in the shoes of his mother, right? He is the heir. And he can say, listen, nobody gave him any rights to sell this. He didn't own it, did he? So therefore, he can cancel the sale, says Rava. I mean, come on, that's ridiculous. I mean, when a guy says specifically, I'm not going to compensate you, I'm not giving you any kind of property insurance, he means against other people. I mean, cut out this business of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, for God's sake. That's all a bunch of garbage. It's you. I can see right through that mask, and you are the same bum. And therefore, obviously, you're going to have to compensate the guy against the loss that you yourself caused him. So I'm not saying that this magically takes away your right to protest the sale. That's a legality. It takes a lawyer to see that one. But I do feel that you're going to have to compensate him for whatever he lost. But you're telling me he didn't guarantee this person against loss that he himself would cause him directly? I mean, that's contextual. And therefore, if he messes it up, I understand he has a right to mess it up because it wasn't legally his. So fine. I understand that. But at least you're going to have to pay him back. I mean, we have cases like this. We have normal cases like that. Let's say somebody is planning on getting a field and you sold it to somebody. Then you go ahead and you buy it. So there is just an umdana that a person, when he goes ahead and buys it, it's because he wants to look like an honest guy. I sold it and it's there. But I mean, suppose that he didn't buy it. Suppose he got it some other way. It was an inheritance. Somebody else had bought it that was related to him. It died, left it to him. We don't have that umdana. So the same thing is true over here. Maybe that's the pshat. Another case, similar, where Rava said exactly the same idea, is that Rami Bar Chama says, listen to this case. Reuven sells a piece of property to Mr. Shimon. And he says, Beferish, I am not offering any property insurance. If anybody gets this field away from you because of money that I owe him, well, it's your loss, and I'm not going to pay it back. Okay. Shimon then goes ahead and sells back the property to Reuven, but he makes a normal sale. Now, a normal sale, of course, is achrayut to'ut sofer. I don't know if Gavi is still with us and what's going to be, but there's an awful lot of memory issues over here. The last thing I remembered was that Richie only had that original 4K, you know. I mean, Bill Gates was sure that that would be enough for anyone. I'm not 100% sure what Gavi's memory is. But anyway, we're talking about yet another case over here. Achrayuto utsofer. So we assume that anything that somebody sells is meant to be with achrayut. Fine. What happens over here? So Shimon sells the field back to Reuven at some later date without saying that there's no achrayut. So he does have achrayut. Now Reuven owed money to a guy, and this guy comes along. Now this loan was there before Reuven had sold the field to Shimon originally. So this guy, this is a crazy case. This guy comes along and he takes the field away from the person who now has achrayus, right? So that is Reuven has achrayus, loses his field, and now he sues Shimon because, Shimon, dear, I bought this field from you, and would you believe it? This guy came and took it away from me. Shimon looks at him like he's out of his mind. This guy came and took it away from you. This guy is you. This guy is the guy that you owed money to. Well, I mean, we didn't specify, did we? You sold me this field with achrayus. Now, you happen to have had an old lien against this field, but that lien was from you, you jerk. Yeah, I know, but I never guaranteed you against a loss from that lien. And it looks like that lien has come and taken away this property, not from me, from you. I want my money back. I paid you good money from that property. Oh, so here we have again, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So it's your own money that's coming to be collected from your own field. And you're claiming that somebody else owes Dr. Jekyll the money for which Mr. Hyde had been responsible for getting you into, and he hadn't guaranteed you any payment, but you had guaranteed him payment. Exactly the same kind of situation. Do we assume that when you don't make a guarantee to pay someone property insurance, that doesn't mean that you're not insuring him against something that you do to him? And in this case, you are doing it to him. It's all your fault. So therefore, Rava says the same thing. What do you mean he can go and collect it from Shimon? Nihi de achrayut de alma kabel alei, achrayut de nafshe mi kabel alei. I mean, I understand when Shimon says that you are guaranteed against loss, it doesn't mean you're guaranteed against loss that you yourself cause. Obviously, I didn't mean to give you insurance against yourself. And therefore, Shimon doesn't have to pay back, in this case, Reuven at all. But actually, Rava would be made that in a case where Reuven inherited a field, so he inherits a field from his father, Yaakov, right? Then he sells it to Shimon. And Rashi points out, we're not talking about a Shimon necessarily who is a brother. That complicates matter. So even though normally Shimon and Reuven are brothers, there would be other issues that would be raised if Shimon also inherited the same property and then they split it. So we're not talking about brother Shimon. So he inherits, Reuven inherits, sells it to a stranger by the name of Shimon. Shimon then comes and he sells it to Reuven. Same case. And this time he sells it with a guarantee. But what happened over here is that it was Yaakov's loan that comes due. And Reuven was an heir of Yaakov. And now the original guy who had a shtar against the father, Yaakov, he comes along to the son, Reuven, and he says, hey, kiddo, I have a lien against this field from before the time your father died. He'd borrowed money, and this is my field. So he wants to collect that field. Now, what happens? Because Reuven ended up losing that field. Well, the din is that Shimon has to go and he has to pay him back for his loss or pay off the guy who has the chov. Either way, you want to pay him off in advance. You want to give him compensation ex post facto. That's your business. Why is that? It's because just because the person who collects it was the Baal Chov of Yaakov doesn't mean he's the Baal Chov of Reuven. And we're all agreed that Shimon did sell it back to Reuven with property insurance. Property insurance against his father's chov, that's like anybody else. And therefore, Baal Chov de Yaakov, ke Baal Chov de Alma Dami, and in this case, we agree that actually Shimon would have to pay him back for that loss.